Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. We're in the streets and on the air. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Today we have a very interesting show for you with guest John Barber. John Barber has a very long resume and a very long bio, so I won't read it now, but he'll tell us his story during this interview. And you can also go to his website, johnbarbersworld.com. That's johnbarbersworld.com. He's the filmmaker of The Last Word on the assassination and also the JFK assassination, the Jim Garrison tapes. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with the subversive, articulate, and always interesting John Barber. John Barber, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Cindy, I'm absolutely and totally delighted to be here, and I just love the fact that you call it the soapbox, because that's where I belong, I think.
Well, yeah, I think that we all have something to say, and we all want to be heard, and the corporate media, as you must know, does a very good job at really undermining the truth and not letting it get out there. So I want you to tell my listeners a little bit about yourself, and then I want to launch into the subject about the work you've been doing around the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and why is that work still important for us today? But first of all, tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I'll try to keep that part of it as brief as possible, because talking about the Kennedy assassination is really important. And strangely enough, Cindy, my whole life somehow has been dragged into telling the story of John Kennedy's assassination, not through my eyes or the public's eyes, but through the eyes of former District Attorney Jim Garrison in New Orleans, who was the only person to actually really investigate the case. And after he lost the Clay Shaw trial in 1969, for 10 years, he spoke to absolutely no one about his case or his investigation because of how distorted the media and the government made everything. And the only interview he ever gave, he gave to me in 1980, which was the year after I had created Real People. So I'll try to get past my childhood was right out of Charles Dickens. I was born in a Salvation Army hospital in Toronto, and I came from a severely dysfunctional home long before it was popular.
Right.
I became a dropout at 15, and the only thing that sort of saved me from insanity in really emotional and intellectual unhappiness as a child was I had a sense of humor that I wasn't aware of. It was kind of an impulsive defense mechanism. And we had just before I left school when I was 15, we had an extremely fat teacher in our eighth grade at school. He not only was he fat, he was extremely mean. And you might remember in those years, we seldom saw fat people.
Right.
In any event, one day he came into the school and sat down in the classroom after verbally abusing a couple of kids. And when he sat down, he started to complain that his ankles were swollen. And I hollered out from the back of the room, "How can you tell?" Well, they dragged me into the principal's office and beat me with a leather strap that was soaked in lemon juice, for God's sake.
Yeah.
I was kicked out of the school and decided to stay out. So anyway, I ran away. I came to America. My father had left the peace. He had left our home, and gone to the peace and quiet of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
He joined the Canadian Army. Anyway, I came to the United States, and I was down here for a few years, and I used to get into arguments with people about politics. I'm only 16 or 17 years of age. And then one day the FBI showed up and arrested me. And I had...
What?
Yeah, they arrested me for being a commie. Somebody uh-huh. reported me for being a commie because I was defending Canada's health care system.
Oh, my goodness.
This was a long, long time ago. Anyway, I had little contact with my mother, but I get to make one phone call, and I called her, and I asked her to send me $29 to San Pedro. They put me, incarcerated me in a place called Terminal Island.
Mm-hmm.
And she said I'd gotten into trouble on my own, and so I would have to get out of it on my own. So I was incarcerated for 6 months. Then a couple wow. of Mexican kids who were also locked up. They don't lock up the Mexicans anymore. They let them stay, but at that time they used to lock the Mexican illegals up. Anyway, a couple of them used to do the laundry, and I just couldn't stand being locked up, so they suggested that they would help me escape. So I cased Terminal Island and the facility for days and days, and finally figured out how to do it. So anyway, they arranged to put me in a laundry chute on the third floor with the laundry. They sent me down the chute right to the basement. I was on the basement, and since I knew everything about the facility, I could get out the front easily. But everything was locked. It was a Wednesday during the week. How could it be locked? Mm-hmm. Every door was locked, Cindy. I fell asleep on all this old laundry, and of course the security people found me. They brought me back to the office and thought, you know, you better smarten up, kid. And I said, well, why are the doors locked? It was July 4th. I had forgot. So anyway, they sent me out of the country, and I went to England and found my father when I was 20. He was a colonel in the Canadian Army. He'd remarried without divorcing. He had this very wow. successful advertising agency in Edinburgh. And he took me there to show me his facility. And I must tell you, I felt like Oliver Twist or David Copperfield. I thought, my God, Cindy, I'm finally going to be rich and I'm going to be well-fed. And he showed me this terrific studio he was in, and he was recording a commercial. And on the screen was this little sort of Pillsbury Doughboy character. And my father sang in this beautiful baritone voice the joys of this Pillsbury Doughboy character. And he looked at me afterwards with this big smile and said, son, what do you think? Now, he had told me beforehand he was going to introduce me to his new wife and that I was going to go come and live with him, and I was 20 at the time. And I don't know, Cindy, why I said this. And I said, Dad, you mean to tell me that you left a wife and three children to come here and sing to a donut? Well, I'm telling you, he did everything but kill me.
Oh,
and I
my
never
goodness.
Saw him again. I had no money. And so what I did is I auditioned for a British repertory company. I was there for a year. I was invited to join the Bristol Old Vic. But England was too small and too cold and too gray and too different for me. And Cindy, I did not want to escape from reality, which is what being an actor was. I wanted to celebrate reality. I wanted to enjoy life, even though I had nothing enjoyable about it. I knew I didn't want to escape from it. So I snuck back into the country.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I came a comic because I had this facility of being able to say these things, and I became very, very successful. I was one of two people to appear on Art Linkletter's Talent Scout show. Merv Griffin booked me a half a dozen times, and when Merv left Westinghouse to go to CBS, I was put under contract as his replacement. And when I replaced Merv on the show, one night my ratings were higher than Merv's. Anyway, when they hired David Frost, because the owner of Westinghouse, when he went to England, could visit 10 Downing Street, and he could visit Buckingham Palace, but if John Barber were the host, what's he going to visit? Terminal Island in San Diego.
Uh-huh.
So in any event, I was hired by Channel 11, which was a Metromedia station there, and given this poor man's Saturday Night Tonight show, I was the first person to book Red Fox on television. And then somebody came to me and said, they're holding auditions for a morning news show at ABC called AM Los Angeles. There were about 60 or 70 of us who auditioned. And because I did so much topical material, Cindy, I knew everything that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And since my hero had been Jack Parr,
I remember.
You might be too young to remember Jack.
Mm-hmm.
But he was by far the best. He was at home with intellectuals like Gore Vidal or Malcolm Muggeridge or the guy that, who was that? Gore Vidal's arch enemy, William F. Buckley.
Yes.
I mean, he had these kind of people on all the time. Johnny Carson was totally incapable of interviewing these kind of people. And what Jack did was a monologue at the top of the show. So my ambition was to do that kind of a show, and that's really why I had become a comic. So I could do that at the beginning of the show. Anyway, I got the AIM show. And it went from a zero rating to a 4, where we were bumping heads with the Today Show, in 4 months. I interviewed Muhammad Ali when nobody would have Muhammad Ali on the air. Now, today, every American alive thinks that Muhammad Ali was a hero.
Right.
But back in 1970, 97% of Americans either wanted him dead or in prison because he said, white people have caused me more trouble in America than yellow people have caused me in Vietnam, and I'm not
right.
going over there. Only Howard Cosell would put him on the air as a sportscaster in these little 10-minute segments. I had him on for an hour, and he told – I'm going to tell some of the wonderful stories later that he told me about why he became as arrogant as he did. Also, I'll tell you a wonderful quick story about Cesar Chavez. I was the only person to put – there was a thing called the Chicano Moratorium March in
right.
Los Angeles.
Right.
Nobody knew anything about problems that the Chicano community was having anywhere in America, especially in Los Angeles. They were going to have a massive demonstration. I booked two of the leading spokespeople on the show. To this day, Cindy, I remember their names. Gonzalo Javier was one of them. And there was a fellow named Ruben Salazar, who was a Chicano columnist for the L.A. Times, who was shot and killed by a cop with a gas canister. The guy shot him right in the head and killed him. Anyway, they arrested a fellow named Corky Gonzalez for causing the cop to shoot Ruben Salazar. We were doing the show, and we got a call from Cesar Chavez. And Cesar asked if he could come and do our show. Well, of course, I was thrilled to have him on the show.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to tell you kind of a little selfish story. I began as the first person in America to review movies on the news, and this was a news show. The program director, a guy named, or the general manager of this station, John McMahon, hated me. He never thought it would work. But since it was a live show, I did it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And since the ratings were so good, but the way he got even with me, when we had people like Muhammad Ali on or Jane Fonda on talking about the Vietnam War, he would never take my clips and put it on the news to promote our show. Anyway, Cesar Chavez comes on. Now, this is just 2 years after Robert Kennedy has been murdered at the Ambassador Hotel, and not by Sirhan. Sirhan, it's 2 years after the fact. He comes on the show. There must have been 40 news people gathered around our studio waiting to take Cesar Chavez into the back alley to do an interview because John McMahon would never use my clips to help promote my show, talking about the media. So, during a break, I turned to Mr. Chavez, and he was dressed in dungarees and a casual plaid top, just the way he was when he marched. And I love marchers. That's why I loved you, because you walk the walk.
We're still marching.
Yeah, well, see, people like me, we just talk the talk, but you walk the walk. So I have enormous admiration for you, because my mentor when I started in the business was Red Fox, and he had a great line. He said, "Heroes ain't born, they're cornered." And you were cornered by that horrible, untimely death of your son, and you were forced to demonstrate. Now, there were thousands of mothers and fathers in your position who never did what you did. And Jim Garrison was also cornered by learning the truth about the assassination. But back to Cesar. I said, "Mr. Chavez, you know, these people here will never take a clip of us talking and put it on the news to help promote my show. And you have much more important things to discuss than my little teeny weeny television show. But could I ask you a favor?" And I was embarrassed to even ask him. He looked at me with a straight face and he said, "Anything you want, John." And I said, "Well, you know, when we're done, they're going to ask you to come out in the alley and put you against a red wall, like a firing squad, and ask you questions that they probably never thought of and wouldn't have asked you if they hadn't heard me asking you the same questions. But when they come up and ask you to do that, would you tell them you have a bad back from picking grapes?" Mm-hmm. And I started to chuckle, but he didn't chuckle. He just sort of stared at me. I thought, oh, God, I'm the worst kind of Hollywood personality, thinking about my own kind of show. Anyway, the show was over. We were stormed by these people from Life and Time Magazine, the New York Times, everybody. And they gathered around and said, "Mr. Chavez, do you mind coming out here so we could do some interviews?" And he leaned down, and he said, "I can't stand." He said, "I got a bad back from picking grapes." So they had no choice but to use my clip. Now to Garrison. Like most people, I believed what the government had told me about Lee Harvey Oswald being the lone assassin. But since I was a street kid, I wondered why they Garrison arrested Clay Shaw in 67, and it took him 2 years to get the trial in the relatively small jurisdiction like New Orleans. I kept saying to my friends, "Hey, if a guy doesn't have anything, why doesn't the government get out of his way and let him fall on his face?" But they did everything they could to interfere with it. So that was just in the back of my head. Anyway, he lost the case. I forgot about it. I'm in a bookstore one day, and I see a book called Heritage of Stone. And it says, by Jim Garrison. So I picked it up, and I read it standing in the store. Wow. I could not close the book. Immediately, I got home. I called New Orleans, asked for the DA's office. The phone rang, and this bass baritone voice picked up the phone saying, "Hello." Sorry, I can't imitate him. I don't have a bass baritone voice. I said, "Could I speak to Mr. Garrison, please?" He said, "Speaking." I said, "Mr. Garrison, my name's John Barber. I do a morning show here in Los Angeles. We're the highest rated show here in town. I just won my first Emmy, and I'm sure I'm going to win a few more. And I just read Heritage of Stone." And he chuckled and he said, "Oh, you're the other one. I only sold two copies." I said, "But I can't believe what I'm reading, that you literally had to sue Time Life magazine and take it to the Supreme Court, and they had to order Time Life to give you the Zapruder film." He says, "That's true." And I said, "One of the doctors, Dr. Zink, was prevented from guys with uniforms on and medals on from performing a proper autopsy aside from Dr. Hume?" And he said, "That's right. He came to New Orleans for the trial." I said, "Well, my God, people don't know this. Would you like to come on and do the show?" He said, "John, you'll never get away with it." I said, "What are you talking about? We're live. I'll talk to you for 45 minutes. We'll open the phone for 45 minutes. It'll be terrific." He said, "John, you won't get away with it." I said, "Please, would you do it? I'm telling you, people will love you." And he said, "While we're at it, John, do you know that 83%, according to a Harris poll, wasn't a Gallup poll then, a Harris poll, he said 83% of all Americans believe there was either a conspiracy or that Lee Harvey Oswald didn't do it all.
Uh-huh.
And he said, but only 21% want a new investigation. He says, what does that tell you, John? And I said, Mr. Garrison, it tells me that I know what my mother and father did in the alley or in the back seat of a car or in the bedroom to conceive me, but don't ever tell me my mother's not a virgin. And he howled.
Uh-huh.
He said, if you ever write a book, that's your title. Anyway, I booked him on the show. Following week, I was fired.
Wow.
He was canceled. Now, there was one lady who had called. If you've seen any of these shows now, like Larry King or any kind of show on television that purports to have phone calls, you'll notice that one phone call is never more than 18 seconds, and then they're off. Once in a while on C-SPAN, Cindy, during book TV when they have good authors on, once in a while they have a minute or a minute and a half conversation with somebody, but never longer than that. One day on my show, an elderly lady called who was going to commit suicide. She had once been a famous ballerina, and some people knew her name, but I'd never heard of her.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to her on the phone for 45 minutes live, just the two of us talking about her life, why she was committing suicide, and I couldn't really talk her out of committing suicide because people have, you know, they have to face what it is that they have to face. So the audience saw that I wasn't trying to talk her out of it. I was just giving her a sounding board. Anyway, she lived. Okay. I get fired from my show, and Garrison gets canceled. This lady went to the largest shopping malls in Orange County with a group of other ladies and gathered 10,000 signatures to keep John Barber on the air. She brought these boxes herself and one other lady to KBC at ABC at Talmadge in Hollywood where we did the show, and there was a general manager. And there was the news director. Now, the news director had asked me if I would go on the news to do reviews as well as the morning show. But John McMahon, the general manager, said, no, he's not doing them. He just did not like me. Because every time I had an argument with him, I told him I will improve the 6 o'clock news by not even appearing on it. And he looked at me with disdain. He said, what are you talking about? I said, well, John, in the morning when people go to work, they turn off the TV, right? He said, right. I said, when they come back home, what do? The first thing they do is tune on the TV. Well, if they've been watching me, they tune on to Channel 7, ABC. I'll improve your rating. Well, he thought I was being arrogant. Maybe I was, but I was also being truthful. Anyway, she presented the boxes of 10,000 signatures to him and left. And I said to him, John, you don't want to give people the impression you're getting rid of me. Now, I know you don't like me. It's obvious. And I'm not really fond of you because I don't think you know how to run a television program. You may know how to run the business of a station, but it's show business, you know? It's not business show. You have to have the show before somebody can tune in and you can do business. I said, let me go on the news so the public knows you haven't gotten rid of me. And Cindy, he looked right at me and he said, the public, they don't hire you. I do.
Wow.
And so I was finished. Anyway, 10 years later, I went over to NBC for 5 years. Periodically, I talked to Mr. Garrison on the phone. During the Vietnam War, we would have conversations. During the Watergate break-in, where there were some names.
Hello?
Then in 1979, I beg your pardon?
I lost you for a second. You said you had conversations during Vietnam, then you said during the Watergate break-in you had conversations, and then I lost you for a couple seconds.
Oh, yeah, and a couple of names came up during the Watergate conversations that had come up in Dallas. Anyway, in 1979, I create Real People, which gets on NBC, and within a year, it is the number one show in America. And we were getting 25,000 pieces of mail a week. We would get a 50 share in Middle America, which was much higher than Lucy ever got or MASH's farewell show ever got. It was by far the most influential show in the country, and it, as such, I got to change some laws in America, aside from being a very entertaining and interesting and intelligent show where I would let people tell their stories. I felt if I had that platform, I had to tell some real stories, and we did, and we got the Missing Children's Act passed. We got a commendation for the Navajo Code Talkers. We were the first to tell the story of the Tuskegee Airmen. I mean, it was a massive show. You might remember it.
Yes, I do.
Anyway, as happens in this business, the owner of the show was a guy named George Slaughter, who had been the owner of Laugh-In. And I met him when they did the revival of Laugh-In because he called me and asked me if I would be critic at large, not only on the air, but would I help write it. And by the way, the revival of Laugh-In, those four specials, was where Robin Williams was introduced to America. I met him and befriended him when he was 26.
Mm-hmm.
And he was obviously, absolutely a volcano of ad-lib talent, much like Jonathan Winters was. He was a true comic genius. Anyway, when somebody has a successful show like that, the network comes to them and say, do another show. So Slaughter wanted to do a show called Speak Up America, which was sort of a rip-off. The idea, remember that wonderful movie Network?
Yeah.
Heath Finch, I'm mad, Howard Beale, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore, William Holden, Faye Dunaway. When I reviewed it, Cindy, I said, it's the only movie ever made in America where you'll go to it to listen to it and not look at it. Chayefsky's script is more profound today than it was back in 1977. Anyway, he books Marjo Gortner to do the show. Now, I'm working 20 hours a day writing all the stories and editing all the stories for real people. The show was literally mine. And Slaughter was having trouble doing this Speak Up America thing. And he kept coming to me and saying, will you help me with this? It's not quite working. And I said, I can't, George. I'm just too busy. Anyway, I read, 1980, page 13 of the Los Angeles Times, a story that's months old. And it's the House Select Committee on Assassinations has concluded that four shots had been fired. They found a dicta belt of a police officer, a motorcycle officer, left the recording open, and it revealed that four shots had been fired. Well, I read that article, and the first thing I did is I picked up the phone, and I called Jim in New Orleans. And he answered the phone, and again I said, Mr. Garrison, I could never call him Jim, except you. I always called him Mr. Garrison. I had so much respect for him. I said, do you feel vindicated? He said, John, I feel like a blind man who's gotten a very small trophy in a dark room. Only I know I got it. I said, well, what about Cronkite and Huntley and Brinkley and Reynolds from ABC? Isn't everybody just swarming all over you to do an interview? He said, you're the only person from the news, and you're not really news, who has called me. Now, the interesting thing is, he had told me initially that he believed the Warren Report because he hadn't read it. Now, here's a guy who was former FBI agent. He was a colonel in the Air Force Reserve. And on his wall in his office, Cindy, was a picture of him at Dachau. A picture of him at Dachau when the prison was liberated by the Allies. And he wrote underneath it, lest I ever forget, he had that on his wall. Uh-huh. He had 1,000 books in his library. And when I was interviewing him, I'll get to the interview in a minute. Anyway, I said to him, maybe now I can tell your story. And he said, I doubt it, John. Nobody wants to hear it. I said, I got the number one show. My boss has this other show that he wants to be a news show. Let me go talk to him. So I said, I'll call you right back. So I went in and I said to George, I said, George, I'll do one story. And George says, what's that story? And I showed him the clip from the LA Times. I said, I've been trying for 11 years to get this man on the air. let me do this story. I said, okay, but you got to do some real people stories while you're in New Orleans. So I went down there. I put Jim Garrison on camera for 3.5 hours. Cindy, it was the most thrilling, frightening 3.5 hours I ever spent in my life. It was totally enthralling. An education I couldn't believe. And when it was nearly over, I said, Mr. Garrison, you're very conservative. You're not aligned to any political party. And yet, you came from the FBI. You came from the military. Whatever made you think you could take on the federal government? And he said, John, I guess as a kid, I saw one too many Frank Capra movies. Well, Cindy, that was me. I was Jimmy Stewart. I mean, I grew up believing all that stuff. And the sad thing about America today is now the disappointments outnumber the hopes. When I was a kid, the hopes always outnumbered the disappointments. My latest disappointment yesterday was seeing Liz Warren talk about the fact that Israel was right in doing what they did to Gaza. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I was heartbroken because I thought maybe she might be the front runner instead of Hillary.
Oh, she's just a Zionist, and you know, well, there are 535 Zionists in Congress. So
you're absolutely right. And this morning on my Facebook page, in order to keep my Facebook page alive, because I don't know much about computers and stuff, I always make a comment or a joke. Which became the foundation of my first book, John Barber's Facebook page. And this morning I said, America, a very, very big country, the little ex-presidents. Israel, a very, very tiny country that selects them.
Oh, yeah, I saw that one. We're Facebook friends, by the way. And that's connected.
You have no idea. I wish I could give you physical hugs, but I have to give you what they call e-hugs, whatever they are. Anyway, Garrison bought 3 sets of the Warren Report. Now, it's 26 volumes, so it's like 72 volumes. He had one in his car, he had one at home, and one at the office. And here's the story. It's so good, the story, that we have to do a two-parter. So the Speak Up America, Marjo Gortner is the guy that substitutes for me. And when we cut in Jim Garrison, and the first thing you see is Mr. Garrison leading forward, very bulbous eyes, but he was immensely sincere. And this wonderful, warm, captivating voice says Lee Harvey Oswald had nothing to do with the assassination. Matter of fact, he didn't fire a shot. As a matter of fact, he had nothing to do with the assassination. Now, people were spellbound. They're sitting in that studio, and everybody stopped to stare. Now, here in this 7 minutes, we introduce Garrison and why he did what he did in arresting Clay Shaw. Now, people cannot wait for part two. Now, this gets back to one of your very opening statements about the media. During the interview with Garrison, I said, Mr. Garrison, how many shooters do you think there were? And he said it was triangulation. He said it's a military operation, and John Kennedy was an absolute sitting duck. Triangulation means that we're probably 3 shooters, but there's probably somebody there to retrieve the shell, dismantle the gun. And he said, since this was such an important operation, there might have been 3. You had to have somebody on a radio. He said somebody was behind the book depository, somebody was in the Daltex building, and somebody was in front. So then I said to him, well, how many people do you think really knew he was going to be shot? And he said, John, it's on a need-to-know basis, as you know, in the military. And he said, but my guess would be about 32. And then he recounted the people at the CIA and the other intelligence services, the military intelligence apparatus. So anyway, I put together the second portion of the show. And I'm sitting at home in a rented house because with the new money I'm making, at the time, Cindy, I was making $22,500 a week. Whoa. That is an enormous amount of money.
Yeah.
And I decided to build my newborn child and my wife who had struggled with me all these years, this beautiful home in Toluca Lake. I'm in the middle of building that. We move into a rented home. We tune in to watch part two. And up comes Marjo Gordner, and he's looking at Mr. Garrison and says, "Mr. Garrison, how many shooters were there?" And there's a cut to Jim Garrison. And he says, 32.
No.
And I screamed at the set. And the moment I screamed, the phone rang. And it was George Slaughter. And he said, "What do you think?" And I started screaming at him, "What did you do? What did you do?" So he starts telling me in this calm voice that Jim Garrison is a nut, that he's insane, and he deserves to get what's getting to him. And I screamed from Anthony's end. I hung up the phone. Now I call Jim in New Orleans, and I'm sobbing. And I said, "Mr. Garrison, please sue NBC. Sue George Slaughter, because this is deliberate, malicious libel." And the lady, her name was Donna Cantor, who helped Slaughter at midnight edit it. She was a lady I had hired because her father, Hal Cantor, was one of my best friends and Hollywood's best joke writer, and helped me write a lot of my material when I was beginning. So as a favor to him, I hired his daughter. At midnight, Slaughter had called her to come in, re-edit this, and ordered her not to call me. When I confronted her the next day, she broke up bawling. Anyway, when I called Mr. Garrison, he was as calm as can be. And he said, "John, I'm used to it." I said, "Please, you must sue them. I'll be the witness, honest to God. I just don't understand why somebody would do that." He said, "John, I repeat, I'm used to it. If I sued everybody who did this to me, I would be in a courthouse for the rest of my life." He says, "Besides, my family loves your show. All you have to do is send me a Real People t-shirt." Well,
wow.
It was over. I mean, my days at Real People were over.
Uh-huh.
He did not sue, and Real People died after that. Because, and people in the industry, when I said Real People's over because I'm the show, thought, well, you know, I'm not like Archie Bunker in All in the Family, you know. Archie Bunker was clearly the star of that show and got $100,000 an episode,
uh-huh,
justifiably for being so, but I was just one of four or five hosts, but nobody knew I did all the writing. And I said, "Listen, how many times has there been an article about the jumping frog at Calaveras County? They have one every year for 100 years. But whose article do you remember? You remember Mark Twain's.
Uh-huh.
It's not the story, it's the storyteller." And I said, "You can't take Neil Simon's typewriter and give it to somebody else and expect the Sunshine Boys to jump out of it. You know, it's the way somebody puts those 26 letters of the alphabet together." So I had a very difficult time in Hollywood after that because I became sort of known as a troublemaker. Well, the years passed, and in order to save the videotape, I would spend my own money to have it transferred every couple of years because that stuff disappears. Now, 1992, I read Oliver Stone is
right.
going to do JFK.
Right.
Okay, so I call Oliver's office. He doesn't get on the phone. He sends his assistant. I said, "Listen, I've got 3 hours of the real Kevin Costner." I said, tell Oliver he can be the executive producer, but Jim Garrison says that only I should make the documentary. But Oliver's doing the movie, and a year after the movie, he can release this documentary. She called me back, and she said, "Send over the tape." I said, "You send over Oliver. I'm not letting this out of my hands." I never heard from them again. But 2 days later, I got a call from Elizabeth, who was Jim's daughter, and said, "Do you know somebody named Rosie in Oliver's office?" I said, "No." She said, "Well, we talked to her a couple of times, and she said, Liz said that Rosie called and suggested that the Garrison family and Mr. Garrison, now Jim is on his deathbed." And not to help John Barber tell his story, it's probably not a good idea because of the reputation I have in Hollywood. And so I said, "Well, what did your father say?" And she said, "My father said, screw Oliver Stone, John, trying to tell my story since 1970. So we had their total cooperation. The material he gave me, which could make another documentary, and I hope to do part two about how the American media assassinated John Kennedy also. But in any event, I made the documentary. It won the San Sebastian Film Festival Award. It was a huge hit all around the country. I could never get it shown in this country. Nobody would air it. Nobody. My close friend who brought me to NBC, Tom Brokaw, when he was doing a show on the assassination 5 years ago, I called him and I said, include a 5-minute clip from my documentary. He said, no, and hung up on me.
John, now, John, can I interrupt you really quickly? Can you say, tell my listeners the name of the documentary?
Oh, yes. The documentary is called The Garrison Tapes, but The Garrison Tapes is now in a much better form, Cindy. It is in a DVD called The Last Word on the Assassination. The Last Word on the Assassination not only includes the documentary, but includes a panel discussion done at UNLV of the three best in the business. It's 58 minutes long. It includes Joan Mellon, who wrote the best book on Garrison, A Farewell to Justice. It includes Jim Mars, whose Crossfire was one of the foundations of Oliver's movie,
mm-hmm.
and Dick Russell, who wrote a great book called The Man Who Knew Too Much. Now, an interesting... Have we got a minute to tell about how that came about?
I'm keeping you on a lot longer because this is so fascinating.
Well, this you will love.
Yeah, okay.
Now, I knew on the 50th anniversary the networks and cable would be covered with this story. So I thought what I'm going to do to bring attention to it, I had heard that Robert Kennedy did an interview with Charlie Rose in Dallas a year ago at an opera house where he said his father did not believe the conclusions of the Warren Report.
Robert Kennedy Jr., you're talking about, right?
That's right. And so I thought, you know what? I'm going to call his agent. Now, my best friend in Vegas is a fellow named George Knapp, who is a great journalist. He's also the Sunday night host of a show called Coast to Coast AM.
All right.
He's a wonderful man. Mm-hmm. He literally helped save my documentary because he kept telling people about it. That kept it alive. Anyway, I thought, I'll call George. And I said, George, if I can hire Robert Kennedy Jr. to come to UNLV and screen the documentary, how much would you want to do an interview with him? He said, John, are you kidding? This is a public service. I'll do it for nothing for you and the university. So I called Dick Russell, because I knew that Dick knew Bobby because they'd written some stuff together. And I said, can you get me Bobby's agent's name? I'd like to call him. And he said, no, I'll call him myself for you. He said, because I'm going to see him in a few days. So he calls Bobby Kennedy Jr. and finds out that Bobby Kennedy Jr. wants $25,000 if he's going to come here and they're going to screen my documentary and be interviewed by George Knapp. All I had left in my retirement fund was $25,000. I said to him, Dick, I says, tell him he's got the money. So Bobby Kennedy Jr. agrees to do it. We book it for December 12th because that was the only time we could get, at the closest we could get to November 22nd because all of their facilities were booked. So we got it. We're going to have 1,200 people want to get in there.
Uh-huh.
We're going to screen the documentary. We're going to tape the documentary, and then we're going to try to put it up on Netflix or Amazon or someplace like that. And if I got enough money from selling it, I would do part two. So I'm all pumped up. The day before, Robert Kennedy calls and cancels. And Dick says, why? And Bobby Kennedy Jr. said, well, you know, I'm represented by Sean Lawton, an agent at Kepler Speakers in Virginia. And I get $25,000 a shot to speak about the environment, okay? He said, they're telling me if I do this, I will no longer be invited to talk about the environment because this is so much more interesting, but nobody will book me to talk about this, so I can't do it. I can't do the show. And he backed out. Now, I said to Dick, I said, do me a favor, I'm going to send you a note. You pass it on to Bobby, that goddamn coward, and tell him I'm doing more for his father and his uncle than he did. When I was in L.A., one of my close friends was a fellow by the name of Robert Blair Kaiser. Robert Blair Kaiser, a former priest, had written a definitive book on Sirhan called RFK Must Die. He gave me his papers and his book and left the country because he was afraid for his life. So I read the book, read his papers, and began to befriend Dr. Thomas Noguchi.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Noguchi, the city council had been trying to get rid of him for years.
Now, Dr. Thomas Noguchi, we have to explain, was the coroner for L.A. County for many years.
That's right, and he conducted the autopsy on Bobby, and you can get the autopsy report, which says the fatal shot was fired from the left rear of the left behind the head because of the extensive powder burns to the scalp and to the hair. And that proved right off that Sirhan could not have fired the shot
right. Because
he was in front. Okay, now, they're trying to get rid of him. Here's a little sidebar about how all of this has somehow infected my life. I was doing at the time I became Frank Sinatra's ghostwriter for all his jokes and his letters to the editors, for which he paid me very, very well. Some of them are even quoted in Kitty Kelly's book, His Way. Anyway, I had said to Sinatra one night, I said, you know, you should do an Italian Roots. And he smiled. Now, you may remember that show. It was about Kunta Kinte
right. On
ABC. It was on Monday through Friday. Biggest ratings ever in the history of television. I said, you know, Crosby, your buddy, died on a golf course in Spain. And nobody remembers him. And I said, now, Crosby was a great entertainer, a great movie star. But you're more than Crosby. You're a social force. If it hadn't been for you singing High Hopes for John Kennedy, he might not be president of the United States. You're a social force. You're not just an entertainment force. I'm going to put you on camera. You're going to tell your life story. You keep all the tapes. You keep all everything. You'll never hear my voice. And I'm going to do, it'll be the first visual autobiography ever done. He was so happy. He said, how much do you want, kid? I said, I don't want anything. 10% is fine for me because this would make absolutely a million. So we started to work on it. He said, write out the presentation. I did. Now, what happens is that one of his best buddies was Bill Holden, the actor who was an alcoholic. Bill Holden fell down drunk in his condominium in Santa Monica, hit his head on a coffee table and bled to death. The LA Times said that he had a heart attack and fell down. That's how they reported the story. Thomas Noguchi does the autopsy and reports that this is the alcohol blood level. He fell down in a drunken stupor, hit his head, and bled to death. Well, Sinatra went nuts. And so he joined with the city council to get rid of Noguchi. Now, here I am with Noguchi's lawyer creating this committee to retain Noguchi as the independent coroner. And, of course, not only do I lose, they get rid of Noguchi, but Sinatra never spoke to me again. And I told Dick, I'm going to put that in a letter, you get that to Bobby Kennedy. Because if I can do it, and I'm not related to any of these people, he certainly should have the balls to come forward and do it. Dick did it and said he just won't do it. Now I have the money that I was going
to
spend.
Right.
And I thought, well, you know, I might as well give it to some people worthwhile. And those I thought who were most worthwhile were Joan Millen, Dick Russell, and Jim Mars, who devoted their lives to trying to tell this story. And then again, the people at UNLV kept coming to me and saying, John, somebody got to see your film. You know, we'll give you the theater for almost nothing, a smaller theater. Please do it. So that's how we mounted it. Now, it's over. I'm broke. We put the DVD up on Amazon. And Amazon has 500,000 titles of movies and documentaries. We went up there at night number 324,000.
Uh-huh.
In 3 days, we were 24,000.
Uh-huh.
In a week and a half, we were 1,000. And in 2 weeks, we were in the top 100. And to this day, only word of mouth, Cindy, and I don't know where it's coming from.
Uh-huh.
We sell 3 DVDs a day.
Wow.
Just as if by magic, all around the world, people have found it. And I must tell you, and I must tell your listeners, there is absolutely no other film or book that you would ever need to understand the entire scope of the Kennedy assassination other than the last word on the assassination. There will only be 2 films 50 years from now at the next anniversary that are ever remembered about this murder by our government. That is the Zapruder film, some of which has been doctored, and the last word on the assassination. You will see things in Jim Garrison's story that will literally blow you away. When you talk about the corruption of the media, NBC sent a guy named Walter Sheridan with orders to sabotage Jim Garrison's investigation. Jim Garrison's main witness was a guy named Perry Raymond Russo. He was an accountant at the time. And he was there at a meeting with Clay Shaw, David Ferry, and Lee Harvey Oswald, where they talked about how they were going to kill John Kennedy. When he heard about Ferry being questioned by Garrison, he called Garrison and said, "Hey, I was at that party. Let me tell you the story because I don't want to be arrested. I was just there as somebody's friend. It was just casual," but they still told the story. He never faltered in the story. Anyway, Walter Sheridan tried to get Perry to go to California, offered him a job for $50,000 if he would leave New Orleans, go to California, where they had already gotten him a job at $1,000 a week. Perry called Garrison and said that this guy Sheridan from NBC is coming down to interview me at a motel out of town. What should I do? Garrison said, "Come into the office." Garrison wired him. So anyway, Sheridan and the NBC crew show up. They go into the motel room and are bribing him. And yeah, it's all recorded.
Yeah.
So Garrison issues a warrant to arrest him. NBC does a white paper in which they savage Garrison, right? Now out comes all these audio tapes and this arrest warrant for Walter Sheridan. So NBC wants to squelch. And what do? They give Jim Garrison a half hour of late night time to go on camera to tell his story at 11:30 at night. You know why they had to do that? There was a thing called the Fairness Doctrine. Because
right,
when I interviewed Reagan or a Democrat or whatever, I had to put on a socialist, I had to put on a Nazi, anybody who could prove they had 5% of the voting audience, voting public, I had to put on the air. The establishment saw Jim Garrison 11:30 at night telling the truth to the American people. And Reagan said, "We can't have that anymore. We can't have, no matter what time it is, the truth being told to America." And what did they do? Reagan scuttled the Fairness Doctrine. Now, without the Fairness Doctrine, there would have been no Fox News.
That's true.
They would have been all gone.
John Barber, unfortunately, we're definitely out of time because I have to have another interview in a few minutes. But this has been very fascinating. So I will put a link to the documentary that you have on Amazon so my listeners can, go there and buy it if they want to. But if they want to get a hold of you, is there any way to get a hold of you?
Yes, direct email is John Sarita. That's JohnSarita. That's my wife's name, Sarita. It's Hispanic. It's Spanish for little Sarah.
Uh-huh.
John Sarita at AOL.com. or they can just log into my Facebook page, and I'll be happy to answer any questions or whatever they wish. And Cindy, again, thank you so much. I've been an enormous fan of yours for a long time, wishing that I had your courage.
Well, you have a substantial history of subversiveness that I have enjoyed getting to know through this past 55 minutes that I've had you on. And so hopefully we can talk again, because I feel like we barely just scratched the surface of this subject. And I could have a 3.5-hour interview with you like you did with Jim Garrison. So, John Barber, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And thank you for your work, and good luck going forward with all of this.
Oh, thank you so much, Cindy, and keep up the wonderful work.
We will. Thank you so much. Talk soon, I hope.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.
Well, that was the show for today. I hope we can get John on again, because, like I said during the interview, we could probably sit down with him for 3.5 hours to hear all of the intricacies and interesting things that have happened in his life. And I hope you go to his website. I hope you go to purchase the DVD of The Last Word on the Assassination. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, my production assistant, Dee Dee Miller. I'd like to thank John Barber for his work and for giving us the time on the soapbox today. And as always, I'd like to thank you most for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.